Chairman, I have pleasure in introducing Mr. Stephen Mayne from Melbourne.
Good morning, Chairman. My first question today, I'd like to reiterate what the previous speaker said. Orica's a great story. For those of us who remember the shares when they were around $5, obviously it's a terrific improvement to see such great value created. My first question relates to $11 a share of value that we've given away with one particular deal. And I'm talking about the decision in May 2006 to sell our 70% stake in Incitec Pivot for $21 a share through a placement to institutions and a partial buyback. Now, look, it was great at the time to book a $400 million profit and to raise $800 million in cash. But I think hindsight and history now tells us that this is probably one of the great corporate mistakes in Australian history. The Incitec Pivot share price has gone from $21 to $106 since we sold out. So we've actually left $3.5 billion on the table. Incitec Pivot's now worth $5.5 billion, which is more than half of what the whole of Orica is capitalised at. Now, I know we've made portfolio decisions to go into Excel and the other mining services businesses, but none of them will ever get anywhere near a 500% magnificent return that the people who bought our Incitec Pivot shares have enjoyed. So I simply ask the question, why did you do it? I mean, what was the decision-making process? I mean, you know, apart from the sale of MIM, this is the greatest blunder in terms of a poorly timed sale. So what was the thinking? I mean, why didn't you at least do a distribution to all our shareholders so that we could have enjoyed the benefit and the upside? How did you only settle on $21 a share? And what were the mistakes you made in making that decision? What business assumptions did you get wrong? And has anyone been held to account for that? I mean, if there was a particular director who drove that decision and there was division on the board, well, I think that director should be politely asked to retire, because it's a huge amount of value that has been foregone from that decision.
I acknowledge the success of the Incitec Pivot. It has done extraordinarily well. At the time, we talked about this a lot last year, we believed that the size of Incitec Pivot and the nature of the ambitions that it had was such that the company should basically pursue its own destiny. There's an inherent issue where a company with major investment plans and opportunities is a subsidiary, a controlled subsidiary of a company with other calls on capital. Since the decision we made, and we made it, I think, in full knowledge that we had a wonderful business which was being basically allowed to leave home, was that it would do better, and the shareholders would do better, if it ran as an independent, separate company with its own characteristics and its own market opportunities. I think that decision strategically was correct at the time, and looking back on it, I still think it was a correct decision. The issue of whether it should have been by an in-specie distribution of shares or by a sale, we could debate. Shareholders in Orica had a great opportunity to take up shares in Incitec Pivot had they so wished. The price at which it went on reflected, I think, fair value in the market at that time. Subsequently, independently of us, IPL has made some brilliant investments that give them a position in particular in phosphate markets, which were not part of the landscape at the time of the sale. I applaud them for it. We are looking at a company which got its timing immaculately correct in the acquisition of Southern Cross Fertilizers. It's done stunningly well. I'm bound to say, Orica has also done extremely well since that time, and we have done it in the businesses that we believe were part of the very long-term future of the company. The money that was realized by the Orica component has been, in my view, well invested. And I think the opportunity to participate in both companies was clearly what I hope you did.
I think that's 10 years of Mr. Clancy. That's a pretty hard-hitting stuff. Jeez. I think we might finish off on a slightly different note. Can you tell us a bit more about the private equity dealings, Don? They offered $32 a share conditionally. I think if we have a look at a director like Gary Hounsell, he's well schooled in these different private equity processes. At Qantas, he said yes. At Nufarm, he said conditionally come in and have a look and maybe, and then it fell over. And at Orica, he said get stuffed. So we've got the full gamut of experiences there. You've talked about extensively examining the offer, and but you refused them due diligence. So just tell us a bit more about that. They came along and wrote you a letter and said, we'll give you $32. You've then, or we might give you $32. What, was it a phone call? Was it a chat in the pub? I mean, tell us a bit more about how this figure of $32 manifested itself. And then you've said you did extensive examination of the figure. So you obviously internally have done a whole bunch of analysis. Were you perhaps anticipating that the public disclosure of this process would have triggered an auction? Was that your anticipation of what might have happened, or might have triggered a higher bid? Did you, for instance, have, from your examination of your own figures, after the $32 figure was mentioned, did you have a figure which you would have said yes at, and they simply refused to play ball? Because it was a pretty opaque process. We just got a one-page statement saying you told them to get nicked, and then nothing else happened. So can you just tell us a bit more about the process, please?
Well, without going into all sorts of stuff that is a nature of commercial and confidence, can I reaffirm that what we received was not an offer? It's a conditional suggestion that other things being equal, this is a sort of price we might consider. Once you entertain something of that sort, you effectively do put the company up for auction. And we had no intention of so doing. If someone wants to make a bid for the company, of course we consider it. We went to the trouble of the due diligence that we did on this conditional offer because we felt that our own standards of professionalism frankly required it. You can't just dismiss something out of hand, but nevertheless we needed to reassure ourselves that this indeed was the sort of suggestion which was not worth taking any further. We had no difficulty satisfying ourselves about that. And we did not expect to put the company up for auction to the highest bidder, so we simply rejected that offer and went about our daily lives.
Look, I'd like to speak in support of Don's re-election, save for one criticism. I remember the Australian Stock Exchange's corporate governance guidelines, which came out in 2003, said that no one should chair two top 100 companies at the same time. And I think at the time there were 8 Australians who were doing that. Unfortunately, to 11 Australians who were doing that. Messrs. Crawford, Clark, Mercer, Strong, Argus, Johnson, Savage, Cheney, Mansell and Gonski. And we've seen a greater concentration of power amongst even a smaller group of people in the so-called Directors Club. Now, in relation to Don, he's joined the club recently when he stepped up to become the chairman of Newcrest. So now he's chairing a major mining services company as well as chairing Newcrest, a major mining company itself. He's also running the airport. He's the chairman of APAC, which owns Melbourne Airport, and he's also the chairman of Orchestra Victoria, as well as being a non-executive director of Air Liquide. So he's conducting 4 orchestras, in chairing 4 companies, plus he's got another gig. It's in breach of the guidelines, the ASX guidelines about having too many gigs, and there's also no disclosure in the annual report about the dealings between Newcrest and Orica, the size of the business. Now this is a flaw in the corporate law which allows these technical definitions that you don't disclose related party transactions unless you have a financial interest. And the worst example we've ever seen this in this regard in Australia is Rick Allett, who was simultaneously chairing Southcorp and Coles, doing $300 million a year of business between the two, and it was never disclosed. So I'd like to hear some disclosure about the size and scale of our dealings with Newcrest. I think in next year's annual report, you should do the proper thing and actually properly disclose that. How is Don handling chairing, presumably, a major customer of Orica's? And how is he managing his time? Because I just think he's got too many gigs, albeit gigs which are delivering good results for shareholders thus far. Thank you.
Well, there's somebody who has jet my time in the UK. Time is a serious issue, and but I'm confident, indeed the board is confident, that Don can manage the time.
I think in as far as the disclosure of the Newcrest is concerned, we will certainly look at that.
I just want to ask about the Shell faction on the Orica board. We've now got three Shellers. And yourself, Chairman Peter and Russell Kaplan. I won't get up to speak about Russell. I think he's a terrific addition to the board. He's got a great record at Shell. I'm just interested in whether you've all known each other for a long time from your Shell days. Is that how this system worked? I'm also curious as to how Peter Duncan and Cathy Walter are getting on, given that they were at the opposite sides of the NAB war 3 years ago. And I see you've seated them well apart today. I notice they're only sitting on one committee together, on the Remuneration Committee, so I'm just hoping that that's all going all right and that we've let bygones be bygones at NAB. Thank you.
There is a very interesting Shell connection, I have to say. But partly it's nothing to do with knowing people in the past. It's to do with the fact that the pool of directors that's attractive to Orica includes people who've had big process industry experience and who've had international experience, and there are not so many places where you can find people with those characteristics, and Shell is one of the best. The size of its operations in Australia means that we have very senior Shell people here, and there are a lot of Australians actually active in the Shell empire worldwide. People like Russell running a big part of North America for them. People like Peter Duncan running Germany for them. Those people we are delighted to gather, if we can, into the Orica board. And I'd say it's a question of there being a relatively small number of people who have the characteristics and the background experience that we seek, because that's how we approach it. We go after particular skill and experience needs for the board.
Chairman, I think Gary knows what I'm about to say. I said the similar comments at the New Farm AGM a couple of weeks ago. Gary was one of the directors of Qantas who urged his shareholders to sell that business based on a then profit forecast of $942 million. That bid closed 10 months into the financial year. 10 weeks after it closed, we discover that, Qantas actually made $1.079 billion. And the profit forecast based around the sell recommendation was 130 million light. Now, this was an absolute disgrace, the way the Qantas board did that, urging their shareholders to sell manifestly undervalued the business with a totally inaccurate profit forecast.
Stephen, this is an Orica.
I know, and I simply say that my confidence in Gary has been dented somewhat based on my experience with him on the most high-profile private equity deal we've seen in Australia. So I think that the Orica shareholders ought to know that, ought to be reminded of that, and I personally will be voting against Gary simply to send him a message that a lot of people who watched that situation at Qantas were very upset and disappointed with the way the board conducted that process. The Orica process was far better, and I hope that he's learnt from the Qantas process and did the right thing inside the Orica boardroom, which I'm assuming he did. But the record shows what has happened at Qantas. The stock's trading at more than that. It was a manifestly inaccurate share price profit forecast. I'm staggered they haven't copped a class action yet from people like me who sold out earlier based on these forecasts that the share price would tank from their chairman. And I simply say that in terms of having some accountability, I don't think you can do one thing on one board and then wander along at another board and just pretend it didn't happen. This was a very high-profile situation, and it is a black mark against Gary that he was a party to that unanimous endorsement based on fundamentally inaccurate profit forecasts.
Well, look, Stephen, I think it would be quite improper for me to even try to comment on the internal workings of another company board. I'm just not able to do that. I think you would understand that it's a group of individuals who have collectively to understand a particular situation. I have no knowledge of, except what I've read in the newspapers about that. What I have, however, is very specific knowledge of Gary's contribution to this board and the background that he brings to us. He's a great asset as a director, and as shareholders, have my absolute assurance about that. But this is in the context of our board, our needs, and our experience, which is, in the end, all I can comment on.
This might be a guess, Chairman, but I got a sense from your special comments about the retention payments that you might have copped an against recommendation from the proxy advisers and a bit of a protest vote from the institutions. Is that correct?
No.
So you're over 95% support?
I think when you see the proxies, you'll find that by standards of public listed company AGMs this year, they're not bad.
Well, okay, Telstra was 66% against. You're not going to be as bad as that. But I think if I'll be interested to see, but I just got a sense that there might have been an issue around the... I mean, why did you feel the need to give retention payments during private equity? And a specific question as well, did private equity have access to the management during that process? Did they wave a huge check at them and say, come with us and we'll give you 5% of the company for free and you'll make a fortune, and then you had to come back with a, we're telling them to get nicked, but we'll give you a retention payment. Is that what happened?
Absolutely not. The management of this company never spoke to the private equity people. And we put this in place before the specific approach occurred. There was just too much speculation and it's unsettling. We needed to be sure that our people were not drawn inadvertently into something that we might all regret later. I think we had this well in advance of a specific proposal, but before then we went through months of destabilising speculation. I think the scheme, I have to say, is one which I mention especially because it's not a regular feature of Oracle's remuneration structure and will not be going forward. It's a special purpose, special situation matter, which I think was justified at the time.
Just one final one, just on the loans question. I mean, Graham's running an incentive. Well, he owns 413,000 shares. He's got another 350,000 options. So he's running an equity incentive package worth, well, over shares worth 23, 24 million. You've currently lent him 7.6 million, was the peak during the year, including an additional 4.3 million over the year. I think that the Centro situation is going to cause a backlash against executive loans. And if Graham and his management team did happen to blow up Orica's share price, does he have to pay back the loan in all circumstances, or does he have the out clauses which have so made the Centro situation so notorious already?
The notion of non-recourse is that the security is the shares themselves. The worst that can happen is that the executives get zero. And I have to remind you, we're talking here of something which is meant to be part of the incentive package to perform. You get your fixed pay. The fixed pay would not be a competitive amount of money in today's markets. The at-risk component is what executives aspire to achieve. And if they do, they're well paid.
But the question, Don, is if Orica goes broke, are we forgiving $14 million in loans to the management, or do they have to pay it back?
If the shares
are worth zero,
then there is no recourse for the employees involved in the scheme.
So you forgive the loans?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think that's the issue here. That I think it would be better, in light of Centro, I think it would be better going forward if you phase out the loans. And I notice that you've cranked them up this year. You've gone from 8 million to 13.5 this year. Are we going to see an increasing trend in the loans, or are you going to perhaps change the practice?
All I can say is you may be right. I think your perspective on the issue is not right. Bad, hard cases make bad law, and I'd be disappointed if the Centro experience does trigger the result you're suggesting. It might. Honestly. We're going to this year have another look and see if our thinking of a few years ago still stacks up. We've also got to bear in mind that we now operate in about 50 countries, and the scheme that we have has to make sense both tax-wise and otherwise in a large number of jurisdictions. So we are having a review. But I'm going to say to you again that the scheme we have at the moment, although it has some philosophical features which you may not like, is better, in my view, than options. And it's also probably better than performance shares.
Okay, Jim, just finally, I think this will be the last resolution of any AGM across Australia this year. I think maybe the Friday before Christmas should be avoided next year. Perhaps we might be able to go a bit earlier. But I would like to make the comment that Orica has been a terrific success story. There are very few international success stories based here in Melbourne, particularly run by an Australian. You literally, in the top 15 companies, you do not have an Australian running a top 15 company out of Melbourne. So CSL and Orica are two of a very shrinking group of successful international Melbourne-based companies that haven't had to run offshore to find CEOs. So I'd like to say on behalf of the shareholders, congratulations on a terrific performance over the past 3 or 4 years, and good luck in continuing that performance into the future.